Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by Ryan Fonder, who is a frequent guest on the show. Loving having you on. We got to make this happen more often.
Thanks, Sonny.
It's always good to have you on, Ryan. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me again.
So the reason I reached out to you is because in your newsletter this week, you talked about something that I think is kind of a big deal. At least in terms of how we think about the quote unquote streaming wars and where they stand and who is winning and who is losing and all that. And it's that Netflix is going to stop reporting the number of subscribers they have, which is a big shift for them. This has always been their big selling point, is to say, hey, we have so many more subscribers than everybody else put together. We are accumulating the audience. We have it, and they're moving away from that. So what was their reasoning for announcing that they are going to stop doing the quarterly updates on membership numbers and will instead just let people know when they hit big milestones?
Right. Well, Netflix basically wants investors and Wall Street analysts to stop focusing so much on the subscriber count itself and more on the stuff that drives the actual business. So not subscriber counts or ARPU, or average revenue per user, but revenue itself, like the big top line number, free cash flow, which is a measure of profitability that really tells you about the health of the business, and just profits in general and all that kind of thing. Now, they won't stop reporting like the big milestones, so it's not completely going into a black box. But for the longest time, I mean, Netflix's stock has been just insanely volatile. I mean, I remember back in maybe 2015, we reported on the stock taking a huge steep dive after the New York Times wrote a bad review of Arrested Development, that reboot that they did. So the stock's all over the place. It's up a lot now in the last year or so since the great Netflix correction. But basically, they want us all in the press and all of us in the or all of the people on Wall Street to pay attention to the actual business fundamentals so that they don't see those. Perhaps so they don't see those massive swings in the stock price.
Well, and the business fundamentals, it's funny that you say that, the business fundamentals, because when we think of business fundamentals, we think of things like profit and loss and, you know, operating revenue and free cash flow and things like that. But for the longest time, Netflix was essentially seen as the future. They were saying, yes, we're losing money now, but that's because look at all of these subscribers we have, right? Their whole business was based on think about the future.
Yeah. It was like, don't worry that we're not profitable. For the longest time, Netflix was not profitable. So they're like, don't worry about the profits because we don't have any, but look at all the subscribers that we have. And eventually that will get us to profitability. So they're like, treat us like a tech company. Don't treat us like a normal company. Now they're profitable. So they can go out and say, treat us like a normal company. Come on, what are you doing? Now this is, you know, obviously opening up to certain charges of hypocrisy, because historically Netflix has been more transparent with data, particularly when it comes to sharing how many people watch their shows and things like that. They're much more open about their numbers than Peacock or Disney Plus or Max, formerly HBO Max, or any of those guys. But this sense, they're pulling back, although there are some business rationales for it.
You mentioned moving away from reporting the ARPU, the average revenue per user. Is this a function of what is the thinking here? I mean, is it mostly to, for lack of a better word, kind of disguise the total number of viewers, total number of subscribers, or is it something else? I mean, does this have to do with the move, the effort to increase advertising? I mean, that's a big shift as well, because ARPU has been, again, a thing that everybody focuses on. It's like, yes, you have a lot of subscribers or not a lot of subscribers, but you're still making more here, you're making more there. It's an interesting shift.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an argument that ARPU is less useful than it typically has been, because the revenue, each user has a different revenue associated with them now. It's not that crazy, but there are so many different tiers of Netflix subscribers now. You have the advertising subscribers who pay much less, but you know they make a bunch of money from those people through the commercials. And then you know you have the top tier subscribers who are paying somewhere like close to $20 bucks a month or something like that. I forget what the highest price tier is, but it's up there. So partly to correct for the variation, I think.
Yeah, I should go look at my account and tell you, because I'm sure I'm signed up for whatever the most expensive. I want no ads. I want everything in 4K. I want to be able to run it on 17 different TVs at once if I have to.
You're probably paying for like a couple of different password shares too.
I had a couple of them pop up, but not because I gave them the password. Showed up in a hacked list of whatever. So I was getting weird. This is a true story. I was getting weird notifications that somebody in India was watching on my account. And I was like, "That is this spam? What is it?" And then I went to the actual Netflix site. Sure enough, somebody had logged in. I was like, "All right, I got to change password. We gotta get that fixed." Sorry for that digression. The stock price volatility is an interesting thing, especially when you think about it tied to like certain movies coming out or not, because in theory, Netflix having by far the most number of subscribers, turning a profit and like a solid profit at that at this point. And also, bringing in a new film guy who's going to reduce cost. Dan Lin has said he wants to get away from the big budget, spectacles, get towards the more medium. You would think that this would be all very good for the stock. And yet, after the announcement, it went down. I don't understand. What do the investors want from Netflix?
Yeah, what does Wall Street want? It's always kind of an interesting question. I mean, I think part of it's a function of the expectations for Netflix's performance have been so high that any little wrinkle in anything is going to has the potential to tank the stock, at least in the short term. Because you're right. They beat on revenue estimates. They beat the street on profit and on subscribers. But when they're like, we're not gonna report subscribers anymore. And they also, I think, reported revenue projections that were lower than some analysts had anticipated. So that causes a little bit of shifts. But they're still up like 70% from the same time a year ago, which is pretty astonishing, considering the pressure that's on all the other companies and all their competitors.
Yeah, I mean that is the kind of the bottom line here is that Netflix is turning a profit, and I think I saw numbers today from Peacock that they lost another $600 million, but it's slightly less than they thought they were going to, or slightly better than the previous quarter. And it's just like, how is this sustainable?
Right. And then they were like, yeah, but we grew subscribers, so yay.
Well, that is
pay attention to that, not this other thing.
Well, I mean, and that is kind of what I think everybody is hinting at, is that Netflix is trying to change the narrative in a way to their own advantage, because now everybody else is in the we're building subscribers phase. And it feels like they are saying, no, that's not important. The money is what matters.
Right. And all those competitors chased Netflix into this game in the first place. So they copied. They were jealous of Netflix's stock price going up because they had all these subscribers. And they're like, hey, I guess we should spend as much as we possibly can to increase our subscriber counts. Right. And then suddenly Wall Street does a little turn and says, no, actually, we care about profit now. And that has a lot to do with like interest rates and changing the borrowing costs and things like that.
Things beyond the scope of this show, frankly. But all of this is the entire business of Hollywood is tied up in finances and financials and stuff like that. And that's why I think one of the big stories that folks outside the industry aren't focusing enough on is the potential sale of Paramount. You know, Paramount's been on the block for a while. It looks like the two potential purchasers are David Ellison, who runs Skydance, which is a kind of a mid-major studio, does some interesting stuff, and a hedge fund or, you know, I forget who, a private equity right. firm, Apollo.
Yeah,
I think
they're backed by a couple. There's private equity is involved on all sides of this because Redbird and KKR, which are two huge private equity mm-hmm. companies, are backing the David Ellison bid. Mm-hmm. And then you have Apollo Global on the other side, which is an enormous asset manager, private equity company that's trying to team up with Sony in their bid to take over Paramount.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a fascinating question because there are three kind of potential outcomes here. The first is that Paramount just doesn't sell to anybody. That is always the most inertia is always the most likely course of events. But then, you know, if all right, let's deal with the Sony backed play first, because I think that, you know, we would wind up in a sort of antitrust situation if a Sony-backed takeover of Paramount happens, because then you're seeing the number of movie studios reduce from, what is it, five majors to
five
four.
To four, yeah.
And that's you know, I think we are in a moment where the Biden administration, DOJ, is probably going to look at that and be like, I don't know, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in this case, I think the least likely outcome is inertia, because Sherry is under a lot of pressure for a variety of reasons to unload this thing. You know, she's got some pretty huge tax bills coming up. So I think the consensus is that it's very clear that she's going to try to unload this thing. So the Apollo Sony deal, I mean, you know, it's something that the shareholders, the regular shareholders in Paramount Global would probably prefer to see happen rather than mm-hmm. the David Ellison thing, because the problem with David Ellison, perhaps it's worth backing up a little bit here.
Yep.
The David Ellison bid, their proposal is to come in and buy out this company called National Amusements, which is Shari Redstone's holding company. And that is the holding company that owns about 80%, like 77% of the voting stock in Paramount. So even though Redstone and National Amusements don't own that much of the stock itself, they control the company effectively and what happens to it. So Ellison and Skydance would come in, they would buy out those shares, they would have control of the company, and then Paramount would turn around and then absorb Skydance into itself in a stock deal that would value Skydance at about $5 billion or something like that. So that, in effect, would leave Ellison and whoever he brings in to run the place. A lot of people say that Jeff Shell, formerly of NBC Universal, and that's how he would take over the company. It's sort of this weird kind of mm-hmm. convoluted reverse merger situation. The Apollo deal is a much cleaner proposal, because that would basically just be like, here's like $26 billion worth of cash and us absorbing your debt, and we'll just take it off your hands. The problem with the David Ellison deal from the perspective of regular shareholders is that they would essentially pay $2 billion to Sherry Redstone, the controlling shareholder, and say, we'll take this off your hands. That does not benefit your regular, just like, institutional shareholders, your mutual funds, mm-hmm. your anything that has to do with your retirement account or whatever. So they're pissed off, frankly. They're sending out shareholder letters and threatening to sue if this deal goes through. They would prefer the cleaner, more straightforward Apollo transaction, which would buy out everyone's shares.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a little bit of a Barbarians of the Gate explanation.
No, but it's fascinating, because I think, look, I get the sense that a lot of folks in Hollywood would prefer the Ellison deal because they see him as somebody who is interested in movies, somebody who likes movies, but also because they don't want to see that Sony Paramount, you know, merger, the further reduction in the number of places, frankly, to sell stuff. They don't want to lose another potential customer in seeing these two studios merge. Is that a fair read on things?
Yeah, I would also say that I think movie fans and general audiences have this perception of private equity mostly correct. That is, like, if you sell into private equity and take things private, that generally does not lead to good things for the company long term. You're talking about breaking up assets, selling things off in parts, and cost cutting and all that kinds of stuff. So that theoretically leads to fewer movies, fewer TV shows. The David Ellison aspect is interesting because he is a movie fan. At least he is a filmmaker, a film producer. Like, he acted and has directed motion pictures before, so clearly he's interested in, you know, maintaining this asset. It's just a question of if he's the right person to do it.
And there's it's interesting because there has definitely been a PR push on Ellison's front recently to say, hey, I'm not just a rich kid. I'm out here making movies. I love movies. But this is also a business, which, mm-hmm. you know, is kind of a, it's interesting to compare that to the fate of Annapurna Studios, which was run by his sister, Megan, which, you know, kind of, ran into some financial issues. Skydance is, I think, a little more solidly footed financially. But I'm totally interested and fascinated in this. It feels like a potential win for movie lovers. But as I said to you on Twitter DMs, like, hope is the worst thing to have in any of these situations.
Yeah, anytime you have a studio change hands, it always raises red flags and gets people nervous. And I think there's a really good precedent for that concern. I mean, look what happened with Fox being absorbed into Disney. I mean, that was one studio that just basically disappeared. I mean, they're a label now. It still puts stuff up out within the 20th Century Studios banner, and Searchlight is still doing great stuff, like Poor Things and releasing movies, but, you know, it's not the same as it was.
Yeah. And, you know, again, losing another studio, never a great thing to have happen. Speaking of mid-majors, let's shift over to A24, which is having kind of an interesting moment. You know, A24, for folks who don't religiously follow the ins and outs of the movie business, A24 is a boutique studio. They tend to focus on lower budget things. Your average box office for an A24 film is going to be between $8 and $12 million or so domestically. But they have a big hit in Civil War out right now. It's their most expensive movie. It could end up being their highest grossing domestic movie. And it kind of suggests a real sea change in how they look at the business and what sort of movies they are looking to make, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the success of Civil War, which is looking like it's probably going to be their highest grossing movie, or up there at least with Everything Everywhere All at Once. There's also the sense that they're trying to go more mainstream. I mean, up until a certain point, A24 has been and still is that, you know, hipster Brooklyn studio, you know, the people that all the folks on Letterboxd are always getting excited about. I mean, they've built a brand where people, you know, see the A24 logo pop up before a movie starts, and they kind of know at least a little bit of what that means. And you don't get that with a Sony movie, or certainly not a Paramount movie. So on that level, they've been very successful, and they're trying to level up after building that brand equity. And, you know, part of that has involved taking on a bunch of financing from the investment community, including this New York-based investor called Stripes. And they are looking, if you read this really interesting Bloomberg Business Week story from a couple of months ago, they're looking to go more mainstream with bigger swings and all that kind of stuff. I mean, their bread and butter is really still the indie stuff and the awards bait and the weirdo horror movies like Talk to Me. But yeah, mm-hmm. that might be something that we see coming in the next few years.
Yeah, horror is kind of in an interesting moment right now. I feel like there was some There has been some chatter in recent weeks that there's just too much of it out there. You know, Abigail comes in second place this weekend. You know, folks are saying, well, there's a glut in the market. We need to pull it back with a horror a little bit. But if low budget horror goes away as a reliable moneymaker, I feel like things have gotten much, much worse for the business than anyone wants to.
Overreaction to the fact that, like, right after COVID, it seemed like low budget horror was the only thing that was reliable. And, like, you know, it's classic Hollywood. You overreact, you overproduce, you throw all your eggs into one basket, and then that basket gets some holes in it at some point. So yeah, it's quite an interesting swing.
Yeah, yeah. A24, again, I love A24, but I have always found it to be kind of funny how much focus it gets given the, you know, it does not have the mainstream penetration I think that a lot of let's say, you know, people on social media think. It definitely exists on the margins, put it that way.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, all the hype that it's getting right now, I mean, you can look at another indie production company that was riding real high, you know, just a few years ago called Participant Media. Mm-hmm. And this is the company that, you know, your listeners will probably know, but they did An Inconvenient Truth. They did Green Book. They did they did Spotlight. They did all these movies that won awards and had this kind of sheen of like social responsibility and trying to advance social good. And you know, a couple weeks ago, after trying to sell itself, they disappeared. Their owner, billionaire eBay, former president, e-commerce guy, said, "We're done." And they're just shutting down. So that's how quickly these like heavily hyped studios can vanish into dust.
Yeah. Participants fast. Let's actually talk about Participant a little bit, if you don't mind, because I find this story really interesting, because I mean, look, it's not just that they had a history of making both profitable and award-winning movies. Again, you mentioned An Inconvenient Truth, which is, you know, the highest grossing PowerPoint presentation ever made, and Spotlight, which won the Best Picture Oscar, and like it's an interesting studio, but it was also massively staffed. I mean, I think I read that they had something like 900 people on the payroll or 1100 people, like just some enormous number of people. How does that company just like kind of be like, we're not doing this anymore?
You know, I haven't looked that much into the Participant situation, but it was pretty shocking to see, because they had that track record of success. And if they had like that kind of overhead, at that company, when you're basically, you know, you're producing some stuff that hits the mainstream, but for the most part, not. I mean, they were heavily invested in the documentary space, right? And that's that area started to kind of struggle as the streamers have pulled back on their spending and everything like that. So, but yeah, just the suddenness of which it vanished was pretty amazing to watch.
Yeah, I mean, the streamers pulling back on their spending, I think, is going to be the big story over the next couple years here. You just look at the number of seasons of TV that are going into production, you know, which is crashed by a quarter or so. Dan Lin coming into Netflix and saying, you know, we're going to focus on stuff that's a little bit smaller. We're going to look at the medium budget. Is there a real sense that things are about to get very tight in Hollywood in terms of production and what actually gets made?
Things are very tight. I mean, if you talk to anyone who's in production right now or trying to get work in production, it's very difficult. Like, I know people, I talked to a writer friend just a week ago who's been out of work for a very long time because things just have not returned to the level that they were at and probably won't for a very long time. You know, people were expecting that things were going to come back from the strike a lot more than they did. But it just looks like there's so much budget cuts and fear and trepidation when it comes to green lighting things into production. Things are just very, very slow right now. And that's true. That's true across the board when it comes to film and television.
Is there concern about a potential IATSE work stoppage, the trade union? I know I've heard some folks say, like, well, this looks like folks are holding off on the green lights because they don't want to get halfway through a movie and then, oops, no crew to hold the lights and the boom
not
lights.
Again. Yeah, it's definitely something that people are conscious of. I think I still think there's a little bit of, like, IATSE's never had a full on strike before, so it seems unlikely that will happen. But no one wants to count those chickens right now because they're just starting the general negotiations now. It seems like the craft specific negotiations between the studios and the 13 different IATSE locals have gone pretty well so far. So it's giving people some hope, but the big stuff is still to come. There's going to be hard issues to fight. And after what happened with WGA and SAG-AFTRA, I don't think anyone wants to fully commit.
Well, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. Like, as you know, I like to close by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know about. What is going on in the world of showbiz that folks should know?
Jeez, that's a good one. Well, I mean, we don't have to talk about this now, but there's a big NBA streaming rights story that's going to be coming up. This is a huge deal because Warner Brothers has a lot riding on keeping its rights to the NBA mm-hmm. telecast for its cable channels and also for its joint venture with Disney/ESPN and Fox Corp. And they rely on these rights, and they're getting very, very expensive. Hello, free cash flow. And they are looking at, everyone's looking at places to cut back, but at the same time, sports rights keep increasing in prices. And one of the reasons is because you have people like Google/YouTube and Amazon Prime Video coming in with saying, hey, we got money. We'll come pay for your sports broadcasts. We'll have to see if Warner actually and Mr. David Zaslav ends up holding on to that, or if he ends up letting it go and just adding it to his bonus pool.
Well, the sports question is interesting and important, and I do think that let's drill down on that just for a second, because I do I have a two-part question here. One is if let's say Warner Brothers decides, yes, we want to keep the rights, we want to make sure we still have access to the NBA. Is this when they are going to make the full-on move to having sports on Max full-time? Or is this a play to keep the linear channels, as key components that folks have to subscribe to cable for?
Yeah, it's both, right? Like, they are adding this kind of Bleacher Report add-on to Max, so it, mm-hmm. That involves a lot of NBA and also NCAA and everything like that. So sports is key to its future in streaming, but also they have these, like you mentioned, they have these linear cable networks that they do need to maintain, because those are important, and though declining, they do make money. So yeah, I mean, it's all of the above.
Yeah, and the joint sport, the Spulu, the sports Hulu thing. I feel like that has totally disappeared from the conversation. I had actually kind of forgotten about it myself. Is that still in the where is that? What is happening with that?
It's hard to say because they haven't said what it's going to cost. They haven't said what it's going to be called. So we're all just calling it Spulu. I doubt that's going to stick, but. I don't know. I mean, maybe we'll have like a vote on a name situation, so we can like Bodie McBoatface this thing. I mean, they actually do have an executive that is running it, supposedly. But we haven't really gotten a full update on that yet.
Okay, Sporty McSports Streamer. That's what we'll go with in the joke campaign. All right, Ryan, thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Good to talk to you, Sonny.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode. We'll see you guys then.